On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the grand halls of St. Petersburg this weekend, the fighting in the Mideast has swamped the G8 agenda of big power leaders, but it has not disguised the new and growing distance between host Russia and the USA, or quieted the raging debate in Washington over who lost Russia. In the years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, hopes were high for a Russia transformed from Cold War enemy into democratic free market ally, or at worst, a post-Soviet Russia marginalized on the world stage. Now, instead, Vladimir Putin's Russia is oil and gas rich, democracies in the backseat, and a defiant Moscow is clashing with the U.S. on Iran, the Mideast, and more. There's talk of a new Cold War. Up next on Point, who lost Russia and what now? We will hear some vigorous debate on this in a moment. But first, the news from the G8 summit in St. Petersburg, Russia. Joining me now from St. Petersburg is Neil Buckley, Moscow Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Neil, thank you very much for being with us. The Middle East seems to have swamped much of the agenda there.
Yes, it has. It really dominated events yesterday. I think the world leaders gathered here felt that it was absolutely their duty to come out with a strong statement on the Middle East, and they spent a lot of yesterday afternoon in what was described as sometimes quite a tense meeting, hammering out a statement that they could all agree upon and put that out last night. So that in many ways has been the centerpiece of the summit here.
Why was it so difficult for the G8 leaders to come to common language on the statement on the Middle East fighting that they finally put out?
I think that they, as Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, said it, they all share the same aim, which is, of course, to try and achieve not just a short-term but a lasting peace in the Middle East. But they have very different views on the best way to achieve that. They have differing views on who is to blame for the upsurge in violence there now. And so, there is a process of fine-tuning of these statements where they have to agree on language that they can all sign up to, and they have to agree on the measures that they want to be taken. You do have a difference of opinion. The U.S. Position here very much has been to support Israel's right to defend itself. And to pin a lot of the blame on Hezbollah and on the Syrian government, whereas the Russian line, for example, has been to warn that Israel must not use disproportionate force in response.
Neil, there was hope of a breakthrough on a trade agreement that would let Russia into the World Trade Organization, the WTO here. The U.S., in the end, I think, appears to have helped scuttle that. What about relations between the U.S. and Russia at this summit, in particular between Vladimir Putin and President George Bush?
Well, I think that relations between Mr. Putin and Mr. Bush are not quite what they were. I think there was some genuine warmth when they first got to know each other and during both presidents' first term, particularly after the events of 9/11, when, of course, Mr. Putin was the first world leader to call George Bush and offer sympathy and support. But as Russia's political direction has become clearer in the second term, I think that has created some tension in the relationship between them, and as U.S. criticism of Russia's direction has increased. Looking at the two of them now, they don't appear to be as comfortable in each other's company as they were. And as I'm sure you've heard, there were some moments during their joint press conference, their only joint appearance on Saturday, when Mr. Putin made a quip about democracy in Iraq and how he wouldn't like to see that kind of democracy in Russia, which I think didn't go down terribly well with Mr. Bush or with the American delegation.
Neil, I'd like to hear that exchange for just a moment, if you could stand by in St. Petersburg. Here is the clip from Saturday when President Bush had a kind of barbed comment for Vladimir Putin, who stood right nearby.
And I talked about my desire to promote institutional change in parts of the world, like Iraq, where there's a free press and free religion and And I told him that a lot of people in our country, you know, would hope that Russia would do the same thing.
And Putin responded with a barb of his own.
We certainly would not want to have the same kind of democracy as they have in Iraq, I will tell you quite honestly.
Just wait.
But it is true that we have discussed this issue at length on the initiative of the President of the United States and on my own initiative as well.
We don't want to be Iraq, thank you. And President Bush saying, just wait. How does this close, Neil Buckley, with a sense of solidarity among the G8 or with new tensions, particularly between Moscow and Washington?
I think it closes with a certain sense of solidarity. I mean, I think there's a sense of satisfaction that that all eight leaders have been able to come together around that Middle East statement. And on some other issues, they've agreed to give a push to getting a final agreement on the Doha round, or rather to save the Doha round of world trade talks. But I think there are tensions between the U.S. and Russia. There are suspicions on both sides now. Each is rather suspicious of the other. Each is talking a bit about language of the Cold War being revived. I think it's wrong to talk about a new Cold War, but each is accusing the other of using a bit of the same kind of language. And so that is the way that that we're ending this summit, with a sort of superficial togetherness of the eight, but between the big two, there is some friction.
Neil Buckley in St. Petersburg as the G8 summit comes to a close. Neil, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Moscow Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Joining me from Washington now is Anatole Levin. He's a senior research fellow at the New America Foundation and co-author of the forthcoming book, Ethical Realism, A Vision for America's Role in the World. Anatole Levin, thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Help us understand what's going on here in this U.S.-Russia relation. We see the G8 setting, and it's all splendor and big photographs. But even there, this open tension between Vladimir Putin and George Bush. Back in the U.S., we're seeing some quite head-turning headlines. Foreign Affairs, the new article by Dmitry Trenin, says Russia leaves the West. We see in The Nation, Stephen Cohen writing The New American Cold War. And you yourself, Anatole Levin, having been quite critical of U.S. policy toward Russia since the fall of the Berlin Wall, saying that they have effectively not made Russia welcome. What's going on with this relationship?
There are, or are perceived to be, very different national interests on either side. American national interest has been presented by the Clinton administration, actually, as well as the Bush administration in recent years, as a pretty radical expansion of American power on the territory of the former Soviet Union. That was never going to be acceptable to a Russian state, certainly not even a democratic one. And of course, then there are wider differences, as we've heard, over policy in the Middle East. Although there, one should say that Russia is closer in some ways to America's European allies, so that it's not, I would say, simply a clear standoff between Russia and the West as it used to be. It's, as you said yourselves, a multipolar world with different centers and different players.
You and others have said that the U.S. has, in effect, cornered Russia and pushed it into a more adversarial position than was necessary. It wasn't long ago Russia looked broke and just in big trouble. Oil and gas wealth has been pouring in. They look fairly proud and defiant right now. Do you see Russia as going its own way, as launching its own kind of worldview, its own Moscow-centered orbit, and leaving the U.S., at least, alliance, if there ever was one, behind?
There never was an alliance. There was never a sincere alliance on either side. But that said, I think it would be quite wrong to talk in terms of a new Cold War, where, after all, there was an aggressive communist ideology with at least the rhetorical ambition to destroy capitalism and rule the world. Nothing like that is coming out of Moscow today. Nothing like that is coming out of Beijing today, for that matter. So there are real differences of interest and perception. But unlike in the Cold War, I think, barring some catastrophe, that we will go on seeing what we've seen at the G8, which is that these differences will be managed so as to prevent them blowing up well, you know, into anything approaching a new conflict.
We saw the Council on Foreign Relations had a big convening meeting on Russia. Lots of big names and folks there. Washington Post said they came out with a grim assessment of the recent downward trajectory under Putin, that democracy is in retreat, that corruption's on the rise, the Kremlin is increasingly an obstacle to U.S. interests. That sounds like perhaps not a new Cold War, but a pretty grim characterization.
Yes, well, the signatories of that report, in quite a number of cases, were participants in or even architects of the Clinton administration's strategy towards Russia in the 1990s, which, of course, has proved utterly disastrous and which contributed directly both to, yes, I mean, the rolling back of democracy in some ways under Putin, but also the fact that the overwhelming majority of Russians support that rolling back of democracy. Because the kind of democracy that we justified, at least gave rhetorical cover to, but to some extent also participated in through our policy in the 1990s, led to the looting of the Russian state, a catastrophic plunge in living standards for many Russians, a massive growth of corruption and crime associated with a radical deterioration of Russia's international position.
We've been talking with Anatole Levin at the New America Foundation, expert on Russian affairs. We're joined right now as well from Washington by Stephen Sestanovich. He's former ambassador-at-large and special advisor to the Secretary of State for policy toward the states of the former Soviet Union. Now, George F. Kennan, senior fellow for Russian and Eurasian Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's director of a task force titled Russia's Wrong Direction, What the United States Can and Should Do. Stephen Sestanovich, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks.
So what have we got here? Is Russia going its own way? Is that a problem for the U.S.? Should the U.S. be pressuring Russia toward democracy, toward more open markets, toward the Western view of the world?
Well, I think one important thing to get in sharp focus right away is that there have been plenty of positive developments in Russia over the past several years, and prosperity is one of them. And the emergence of a nascent middle class is another one. The sort of strengthening of some kind of civil society is yet another one. But there have been, at the same time, parallel developments that are very negative. I mean, a very, very strong centralization of power, an increase in corruption, the real eradication, a kind of systematic effort by the Kremlin to do away with political pluralism. Now, all of those are that creates the internal context. Externally, you have a relationship that continues to have positive elements and negative ones, as we had in the 90s. But I think measured against some of the higher expectations that, frankly, American policymakers in the 90s and in the wake of September 11th had for a much closer cooperative relationship, a strategic partnership, a proto-alliance, those hopes have been disappointed. You have a relationship that's essentially underperforming, and one that has sort of become an increasing source of dissatisfaction for not just American policymakers, but Europeans as well, who are beginning to look at what's happened in Russia and make a kind of reassessment. It doesn't seem like the strategic partnership they hoped for. It doesn't seem like the sort of modern European country that they'd hope for. And so there are questions being raised about how much our policies need to adjust.
We'll look at the implications of that for the Middle East, for Iraq, for Iran, and more broadly. Anatole Levin, you say that the U.S. blew it, and they began to blow it big time, in your view, under Bill Clinton. How did the U.S. blow this this option? Who lost Russia and how?
Well, we didn't lose Russia. That implies that Russia belonged to us. You have to understand...
Well, who lost the opportunity that Stephen describes here for a closer alliance, for a different kind of relationship, or do you think it was never there?
I think the possibility for a closer relationship was certainly there, and I think there was blame on both sides for losing it. I mean, if one's to talk of blame, I mean, the fundamental reason, of course, was that Russia, after the fall of the Soviet Union, as a society, as an economy, as a political situation, was not capable of developing as we wanted it to. Now, that was simply, in my view, naive of us, you know, naive and optimistic. Where I think one can speak of blame is of the way in which the Russian state, Russian property was looted in the 1990s and the cover that we gave to that, because that has created great dislike of the West in the Russian population. The second area where I think we can speak of blame is the way in which we tried to exploit Russian weakness in the 1990s, really radically to push forward our power in the former Soviet Union. Now, I'm not saying that Russia has been blameless there. Clearly, there have been things that the Putin administration has done, like its attempt to intervene in the Ukrainian presidential elections, which have been completely illegitimate and should have been opposed. But the way in which we've automatically taken sides against Russia in a whole set of disputes and questions on its own doorstep was always going to bring a very strong Russian reaction. And that, by the way, is completely unconnected with whether Russia is a democracy or not. Any Russian state, any Russian government would have been forced to resist that, just frankly, as any American government is expected by the American people to defend American national interests.
Stephen Sestanovich, what's the cost of Russia turning out not as Americans had most fondly hoped here? What's the cost of it taking its own path, the shortcomings that you described to the world, to U.S. policy and U.S. interest? Is there a cost, or does it matter?
Well, it doesn't rule out all kinds of cooperation, that's for sure. And in fact, this administration has been properly trying to work closely with Russia to, for example, oppose Iran's emergent nuclear program. And that, you know, seems to have produced some results. Where you have had difficulties that do seem to be related to the internal evolution of Russia is particularly in its relations with its neighbors. I think Anatole gets this half right when he says that some of the Russian policies have been basically illegitimate, as it's like its intervention in the Ukrainian elections. But I don't think he's right when he says that it's unrelated to how Russia has developed internally. Russian leaders have made very clear that they regard some of the progressive developments in neighboring states as a threat to themselves, not a geopolitical threat, but a threat by example. You know, the message of the Ukrainian election that you actually had to have free and fair elections was taken by leaders in the Kremlin to be a direct challenge to their political rule.
But has Washington encouraged a new Russian nationalism by pushing NATO right to Russia's borders, by putting U.S. bases in former Soviet republics, by the sort of drumbeat of criticism of what's going on with Russia?
You know, NATO enlargement is one of these issues that Russian leaders have been sort of periodically seized by and then have pushed aside as not terribly important. There was a first round of NATO enlargement in the late 90s that stimulated a lot of Russian debate, and then when it happened, it actually was more or less ignored by the Russians. The same thing happened in a second round, where the Baltic states and other members of Southeastern Europe in particular were taken in, and the Russians were quite upset about it, and then they completely forgot about it and hardly figured at that time. There's another round of NATO enlargement that's looming, by likely to be slower than the others, that does involve some states that used to be members of the former Soviet Union. Ukraine and Georgia are among them, have expressed interest. This is going to be extremely difficult to handle, but I think one shouldn't absolutely take for granted that no Russia can ever accommodate itself to this. In politics, things that become unacceptable, or said to be unacceptable, you often get used to.
Stephen Sestanovich and Anatole Levin in Washington, please stand by for a moment. I want to turn to Russia. Joining us from Sergiev Posad there is Dmitry Trenin. He's deputy director of the Carnegie Moscow Center, senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He authored a piece in Foreign Affairs, current issue, entitled Russia Leaves the West. Dmitry Trenin, thank you for joining us from Russia.
Good morning.
You write that until recently, Russia saw itself as Pluto in the Western solar system, far from the center but fundamentally still part of it. Now it has left the orbit entirely, given up on becoming part of the West, started creating their own Moscow-centered system. Russia leaves the West is your headline. What are the implications of that for the U.S. and the rest of, let's say, the G8?
Well, I think that the implications are pretty important. The Russian leadership, based on the new developments in the financial power of Russia, is clearly designing its own independent foreign policy line. And I think that Russia will be talking with a very stronger voice for the time being, and it will be insisting on a more co-equal treatment by both the United States and the European Union.
You say that that's already creating complications and that those complications are likely to get worse in the near and medium term. How so?
Well, take, for example, the former Soviet Union. It was one thing to stand by passively to watch Atlantic Alliance admit new members to it, whether in Central Europe or in the Baltic. I think that the Russian government has now decided that there's no certainty in Ukraine and Georgia joining NATO, and the Russian government will be supporting those inside Ukraine who will try to block Ukraine becoming part of NATO. I think that you will have also more of a contest in the Caucasus, more of a contest in Central Asia from the standpoint of the of many of the people who form the Russian leadership. It's very much a zero-sum game. The West is trying to ease Russia out of the former Soviet lands, where the Russian Federation still has important interests. So it's going to be more of a contestation.
And a newly rich Russia not ready to go and looking at its own view on Iran, on Iraq, on the Middle East. Dmitry Trenin, please stand by. In Russia, we have a lot of listeners who want to join us. Steve is calling from Holden, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Great to talk to you all. You know, it was striking for me. I have not followed this any more closely than reading the headlines, but when I heard Anatoly's thesis, it reminded me of a speech I heard from Professor Galbraith in the early 90s up at University of Maine, and he was raising similar concerns about the brand of capitalism that our advisors were bringing to the Soviet Union. And his point was that we in the United States would never stand for the kind of capitalism, the open, unregulated capitalism that we were advising up there. And I was just struck by Anatoly's thesis that perhaps we've actually unfortunately, driven that kind of capitalism and maybe given it a black eye.
Let's look at that, Steve. Thanks for your call. Anatole Levin, there's John Kenneth Galbraith being quoted. How would you describe the style of capitalism that broke over Russia with the initial encouragement of the U.S., and why was it so disillusioning to Russian people?
Well, I mean, it was the most feral and rotten kind of capitalism imaginable. And the property that was stolen had, after all, been built up by the Soviet peoples at horrible cost.
You say stolen as in privatized, but to very few hands, making billionaires.
Well, yes, privatized into very few hands, but with minimal, I mean, grossly unfair payments or lack of them. And so many of the proceeds were not reinvested, the vast majority were not. In fact, a great part of them were exported to Western banks, and they went into Western real estate. They boosted property prices in London and New York. Well, just imagine how ordinary Russians feel about that. As I've always said, if America or Britain, my country, went through the kind of experience that ordinary Russians went through in the 1990s, why, you'd have an authoritarian and nationalist backlash in London and in America. There's nothing very mysterious about this. I mean, my own view is that under Putin, this backlash has actually been a great deal more limited and moderate than it could have been. I mean, when I was a journalist in Russia in the 1990s, there were serious fears that this would lead to a full-scale fascism in Russia. Well, thank God that has not happened yet.
Dmitry Trenin, you're there in Russia. Do you have a sense of how Russians look at or talking about the U.S. now? It wasn't so long ago. I mean, if we look back a decade or so, very favorable. I'm looking at polls here that now have a very dim view of the United States among most Russians. Are you picking that up?
Well, Tom, I would say that the kind of... let me put it this way. I would not agree that most Russians would ascribe the ugly face of Russian capitalism to the advice or intervention or involvement of the West. I think that a lot of my friends among the intelligentsia here would blame the West excessively for what Western advisors were doing in the early to mid-1990s, but the bulk of the Russian people actually believe that this was mostly the blame of those who were in power inside Russia, the Yeltsin crowd, if you like. So there's a backlash that you can see right now is also the backlash against the first batch of post-Soviet Russian politicians, and that explains the popularity, the genuine popularity, I would say, of President Putin and his policies of centralization and stabilization.
70 to 75% support rate in polls in Russia for President Putin, we're told. George Bush would envy that. Gary's calling. Yes, Stephen, please.
You know, the politicians run for a long time on problems that have largely gone away, and we can analytically see how they do that, but we shouldn't share the assessment.
Mm-hmm.
We should actually sometimes listen to polls or listen to other evidence that suggests that, you know, a lot of people are, Russian citizens, for example, are moving on. I was struck by a poll recently that showed that 79% of Russians think that corrupt state officials do more harm to the country than oligarchs, the, you know, the big billionaires who emerged in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think they probably got that right at this point. At the same time that we see President Putin's popularity hovering at around 70%, we also see that most Russians, 70% disapprove of the performance of President Putin's government. So you have a very sophisticated and modulated assessment by Russians of what has happened. And just kind of trying to capture in a single theme, you know, the 90s mm-hmm. were bad, the realities of contemporary Russia, I think, is inadequate.
But does that mean that the U.S. should keep the pressure on, Stephen Sustenovich, or does that push Russians away?
Well, the stabilization that President Putin has created and his popularity...
And higher oil prices created.
...could create the basis for, you know, genuinely moving forward to become a more European country, to actually implement the rule of law. President Putin himself has said that corruption is the biggest problem that Russia faces, and that it's endemic, and he acknowledges that they haven't been able to do anything much about it.
Right now, Gary's calling from Sterling, Virginia. Hi, Gary, you're on the air.
Thank you. I'm curious, have our policies not, you know, our policy of all this flag-waving and sword-waving not increased the strength of the Russian and Middle Eastern hand? It seems like it has to me.
When you say flag waving, what do you mean exactly? How would that increase Russian or Middle Eastern standing? In opposition to American power projection?
Exactly.
Dmitry Trenin, how do you hear that? Do you see the U.S. Atmospherically? I mean, we've talked about the bases and NATO, but the sort of the Washington attitude as having driven Russia away in some way increase its strength.
Well, it's interesting that President Putin, in his State of the Nation address last May, talked about Comrade Wolf, and that's a euphemism that he was using for the United States.
Comrade Wolf.
Mm-hmm. Comrade Wolf.
Okay.
Beating up the less strong people or the less strong animals around the world. And I think that one conclusion that the Russian government has come to is that in order to be able to hold your own and progress on the world stage, you've got to be strong and independent. And in fact, the Russian leadership today is totally obsessed with the notions of sovereignty and independence. So I think that this is the conclusion that they have made from watching the United States being involved in lots of things around the world.
And the path to a more effective relationship with Russia, is it pushing hard or is it tolerating or accommodating Putin's view, Putin's way?
Well, the United States is clearly recognized as the most important part of the international environment seen from Russia. On the other hand, the actual, let's say, the actual interest in expanding relations with the United States is at this point pretty low in Russia. It's an important relationship, but it's not a very profitable relationship at this point. You look at Europe as your most important trading partner. You look at China, the rising giant on your eastern borders, and then you look at the United States as the most important international player at this time. But if you look at the actual intercourse between Russia, the actual volume of exchanges between Russia and the United States, it remains pretty low. So it's a very interesting relationship, the one between Russia and the United States today. We never had anything like that in the recent past.
And the U.S. not swinging quite as big a stick there. Dmitry Trenin, outside Moscow with us today, author of the article Russia Leaves the West in the current issue of Foreign Affairs. Mr. Trenin, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Ken is calling from Beaufort, South Carolina. Hi, Ken. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I find that last call interesting as I structure the final part of my comment and question. It was very well handled by your expert there, too. You know, one of the interesting things is, as our democracy, we had rebels on this side of the ocean from Britain as they smartly and compassionately figured our our rules for how we were going to run our democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that you can't, like, stamp that and give it to somebody else because they have their own history. And, you know, the way Clinton handled that, he was smart enough to realize, I believe, or he at least thought that you really couldn't go inside of Russia and create the exact thing that that maybe he thought or the way they should be. And that kind of was one part of the falling out or the
So is it good enough what's going on there, Ken, or is there a problem with the centralization of power in Russia, to your view, as an American?
Okay, well, yeah, there probably always was, even whenever there's still factions inside of the in a way of what do you want to call it, the type of government that they were before, and that always did exist. And now, if I move forward from that, the way that we handled the we isolating ourselves through unilateralism by going to war with Iran too early, in my opinion. Or Iraq, I'm sorry, and just kind of isolating ourselves by being smarter than the group, we should have taken the path of working out our problems with the UN. And now that was one very strong underlying cause. And if you view that from a different, if somebody wants to adopt you, and thirdly, you can remain independent and still receive help from us. And they might have actually done that if we pursued that.
With a little different American posture. Ken, thanks for your call there. Anatole Levin, Stephen Stanovich, I want to get you guys to take the gloves off a little bit if you'd be open enough to do that. You, in fact, have pretty different prescriptions for how to deal with the current situation in U.S.-Russia relations. And I wish you'd lay out that difference for us. I don't think we can really understand the debate in Washington without seeing that. Anatole Levin, what's the daylight between you and Stephen when it comes to how to move forward?
Well, I think there are two main things. One is, I am for confronting Russia where our interests really demand it, as, for example, on different sources of energy within the former Soviet Union. We can't just allow Russia to dominate that. Iranian nukes would be another subject. But on two issues, I differ completely. The first is, I believe that the policies of the Russian state are not dictated by the nature of the present Russian regime. I think they reflect Russian national interests as believed in and seen by the overwhelming majority of Russians. Now, at that point, we're not talking about whether to confront Putin or worsening relations with the Putin administration. Mm. We have to decide whether we are prepared to confront the Russian nation for the foreseeable future. And on ground like Ukraine, where countries that have confronted Russia in the past have generally lost pretty disastrously. The second point is that I would agree with Steve that there are the foundations, I believe, for the growth of democracy in Russia, and I am pretty optimistic that in a generation's time, Russia will be at least much more of a democracy than it is today, much closer to the West, and also much closer to the West in terms of its domestic economic system. What I regard as utterly disastrous is trying to preach democracy in Russia through American state power and propaganda, and associating that with demands that Russia agree with America on foreign affairs, because that only helps to discredit democracy in the eyes of ordinary Russians. And by the way, that is no different from my views on, say, Pakistan or Iran today. I hope that these countries will develop towards democracy. I think that telling them, A, that they have to be Democrats because we want it, and secondly, that being a Democrat involves submission to American interests in international affairs is utterly catastrophic. It only strengthens nationalist and authoritarian voices within those societies.
Stephen Stanovich, is the U.S., or should it go down that road? Should it push harder? And Anatol Levin says it's disastrous to push Russia hard toward democracy and link that to its foreign policy. Do you think the U.S. should push harder on that front?
Well, I think if all of these issues end up being seen as pitting the United States against Russia, then it's clearly going to be counterproductive for any positive outcome.
Dick Cheney's been fairly critical publicly recently, Putin pushing back pretty hard. Are we already into that problem?
Well, you know, there are questions about, you know, how you fine-tune your rhetoric, but I'd put it this way. The issue is not the United States against Russia. It should be a question of whether the United States and Europe have a common assessment of how Russia is doing and how their cooperation with Russia is going. We've been focusing entirely in this conversation on the United States, forgetting that actually, Europe's relations with Russia have deteriorated in some ways even more seriously over the past several years.
And concretely when it came to the fear of an energy shutoff.
Absolutely. The Europeans have been saying very heatedly since January and before that they are concerned about the use of energy and the activities of big Russian energy companies that act not as commercial entities but as instruments of state power. And they've tried to get changes in the essentially kind of demonopolization effort to provide some guarantees for them on that score. I actually think the United States has probably not supported the Europeans enough on that, and they've just taken at face value the idea that, well, it's the Russian way to have energy monopolies, so forget it. I think also it's not a question of saying to the Russians, you know, you have to be a democracy because we want you to be a democracy. That's obviously a loser. The question is there any, there's two things. Are there any other ways to be a modern European country? Because the Russians do want to be that, they say. And I think here, if the United States and Europe stand together to make clear that in the way in which it's acted and evolved internally, Russia's become more of an outlier. You know, a lot of this was not just European dictate. I mean, American dictate. I'll give you one example. Mm. The states of Europe have all agreed on how to run elections. Now, where did they agree to do that? They agreed to do this actually when the Soviet Union still existed in 1990. So what we're talking about is not the United States being off on a wild toot of, you know, unipolar excess, but of European standards being created that essentially only the Russians don't abide by.
And if they don't buy in, should they be ostracized? Should the screws be put on? Or do we have to have a more kind of get-along, go-along policy toward Russia? And wait a generation.
Well, you have to take it case by case, I think. If the Russians don't want to play by the rules of the European energy order, then maybe it should be more difficult for them to list their stocks on the London Stock Exchange, for example. Maybe it's important to support our European friends in calling for more transparency and pluralism in the way the Russians structure their own energy system. It isn't just a case of casting the Russians into outer darkness. I don't think that's the issue at all. We have many areas where we want to cooperate. But Secretary Rice put it, I think, rather well over the weekend. She said, it's going to be tough to deepen our relationship if in fact we don't agree on more things and we don't see the Russians sort of conforming to the standards that prevail throughout Europe. If that's the case, then the Russians won't be in outer darkness, but they will be more of an outlier, and they won't be the kind of partner that we've wanted them to be.
And an outlier with no considerable wealth and power right now, not least on the back of their new energy profile. I want to thank both of you for being with us. Stephen Sustanovich at the Council on Foreign Relations, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Thanks.
And Anatole Levin at the New America Foundation, author of the forthcoming Ethical Realism. Anatole Levin, thank you for being with us.
Thanks a lot.
I want to turn right now to Maxim Schreier. He's professor of Russian and English and chair of the Department of Slavic and Eastern Languages at Boston College, author of Ottoman Yalta, a novel in three journals. Maxim Schreier, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm very well. You know Russia well, and from many years there as a Russian before taking your current seat. How do you look at all this? Was it too much to hope that Russia would be closer to America, to Western ideals of democracy? Do you agree with Anatole Levin that if we just wait a generation, that's where it's headed?
I'm not sure it was too much to hope for. I think it's never too much to hope for if you look at it from the perspective that you're presenting, a very Western and perhaps even American, provincial American perspective. I think if one approaches Russia thoughtfully, delicately, with a great knowledge of an understanding of what it's grounded in, of its complex history, of the very, very complex texture of its society, the fabric, which is multi-ethnic, multi-religious, geographically diverse. I think perhaps if that is the case, we would have less to hope for. In a way, we would have a more realistic understanding of how to approach Russia. Of course, I am speaking here not only as an ex-Russian, and I have been an American for 19 years now, but I'm also speaking as a student of Russian culture.
You call the view or expectation provincial, and yet most Americans would say, well, it's democracy we're hoping for there. And there was the hope of a kind of a collegial relationship. Do you see that coming, or do you see harder times between the United States and post-Soviet Russia on the way?
I'm not quite sure. In a way, it's sort of not really my expertise, but what I do want to say in the remaining time, because I don't think we have a lot of time, is that it certainly doesn't help, and that's what I meant by the adjective provincial. It certainly doesn't help to project the image of American democracy by our president, all due respect, who comes to Russia to bicycle. The Russian papers have been ridiculing this very thing, because certainly if the image of democracy, American-style democracy, we want to project as one of jocks, cheerleaders and cowboys, I don't think that helps the warming of relations and of trust. I think we would fare much better if the president went and toured some of Russia's cultural sites.
And in brief, when Vladimir Putin sort of mocks George Bush's reference to Iraqi democracy, is that seen as by Russians as Putin insulting Bush or just being jocular?
From what I have seen, my sense was that the press is so reluctant in Russia to say anything negative about Putin that I'm not sure it is a reliable source of information. The press, even some of the more liberal papers this morning or yesterday, have had nothing but laudatory things to say about Putin, which always makes one skeptical of the level of press freedom existing in Russia.
Maxim Schreier, author of Ottoman Yalta, thanks for joining us. This is On Point.
Thank you.